Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much can we know about the universe, and what limits our ability to comprehend everything in the natural world? The discoveries of scientists trying to work out the Big Bang, the properties of dark matter, and the workings of quantum mechanics are truly remarkable. But as my guest today will explain, virtually every new revelation about the natural world carries with it a host of new questions to investigate, so that the more we know, the more we realize how much we have left to learn. Marcelo Gleiser is professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. Marcelo, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
The Island of Knowledge is a wonderful metaphor. Can you tell us how you envision it and how it changes as we learn new things?
Right. So the idea is essentially the following. Imagine that everything that we can know about the world, and by knowledge here, I mean mostly scientific knowledge about nature, but you could also include there artistic knowledge, any different kinds of cultural knowledge. But let's focus on the scientific right now. So imagine that this whole thing makes an island. Now, this island of knowledge is surrounded by an ocean of the unknown, the stuff that we do not know about the universe, about the world. And the interesting thing about this is that as knowledge advances, so as we know more and more about nature, you would imagine that the ocean of the unknown becomes smaller and smaller. However, what happens is something a little surprising. What happens is that as the island advances, the shores of our ignorance, that is the boundary between the known and the unknown, they're also growing, which means that the more we know, the more we learn about the world, the more equipped we are to ask questions that before we couldn't even have anticipated. And that is how science advances, always from the known to the more unknown, so to speak.
So is it naive to view science as a direct path to complete knowledge?
That's the point. There is no complete knowledge. And I love that. And science is anything but direct. You know, I mean, if you look at how we have evolved in time, how we have learned more and more about the world, it's been up and down. You know, things that we thought we understood, then we had to retract and we said, oops, wrong idea. We have to restart this idea. One example of this is, for example, the propagation of light. So, you know, we figured out a long time ago that light is like a wave. And so naturally you'd say, okay, if it's a wave, just like a water wave is a propagation in water and a sound wave is a propagation in air, so light must be propagating in some medium. So people came up with this idea of the ether, you know, which was this very mysterious medium whose only function was to support the propagation of light as a wave. And then, lo and behold, Einstein showed in 1905 that there was no need for the ether, meaning the whole idea and lots of papers and decades of knowledge, so to speak, went down the drain. So science only advances, in a sense, when we really have a lot of empirical support, that is, support from our observations. And so it really doesn't go forward like in a march, you know, ahead like a river or something like that. And also, the notion that there is complete knowledge goes against this very idea of the island of knowledge, because what happens is that we are always partially myopic to what's going on out there. We can only see so much of reality. Now, how do we see reality? Well, you know, we are very limited beings in a sense. We have our vision, we have our we can hear, we can touch, we can taste. But that's about it. And of course, that is just not enough to tell us the whole story of the world. So what do? We augment our perception with our tools, you know. So we have telescopes, we have microscopes, we have mass spectrometers and all sorts of sensors and detectors that kind of amplify our vision of the world. And that is wonderful. And that has been how we have made so much progress in understanding nature. However, every one of these machines, every one of these tools has its own limitations. And so we can only see so far. We can only see so deep into matter, which means that we can never have complete knowledge because our knowledge depends on our tools of exploration. And as I explain in the book as well, it depends on some barriers that nature itself is imposing upon us.
Including things like the speed of light.
Including things like the speed of light. And light, I have to say, you know, Einstein is so famous for relativity and for all these things, but his real demon was light. You know, he really could not stop thinking about light, because light is a tremendous mystery. If you stop to think about it, what is this thing that radiates from these atoms, you know, that can propagate at the fastest speed that exists in nature? So the speed of light is about 186,000 miles in a second, which to us scientists and to everybody else doesn't really mean anything. I mean, what the heck is 186,000 miles in 1 second? So one way to visualize that, perhaps, is to say the following. You blink your eye, and light goes 7.5 times around the Earth. Hmm. Blink your eye, boom, 7.5 times around the Earth. So it's incredibly fast, right? Yet, because light does have a finite speed, there's only so much we can tell about reality. And this is what I mean. We now know that the universe, for example, has a finite age. Just like I have a birthday and I have a finite age, the universe also had a birthday, which was about 13.8 billion years ago. Let's round it up to 14 billion years ago, which means the following is that as the universe has a certain age and light travels at a certain speed, it could only travel so far in that amount of time. So we can only see things which are so far, you know, which is not 14 billion light years away, which would be the speed, you know, the distance that light would have traveled in 14 billion years. It's a little more than that because, just to make things a little more complicated, the universe expands. And so as it expands, it kind of pushes light outwards, gives it a little push like a surfer riding on a wave. And so we can see all the way out to about 46 billion light years away, which is incredibly far away, but it's not forever. Now, what does that mean? It means that we are sort of like fish inside a bowl. You know, we can see up to a certain distance, but beyond that distance, we cannot see. It's really beyond our bubble of information. And hence, we are surrounded by a universe that we don't really quite know what it is like. We can infer it's sort of like ours, but we don't really know.
Imagine we could do the impossible and we could see the state of the universe before the Big Bang. Is there any reason to believe we would have any idea what we were looking at?
Oh, wow, that's really the impossible. Well, you see, the point is, at least the way, there are many ways you can think about the Big Bang, right? I mean, and the fact that we can think about it in many ways means that we don't know what the right way is yet. But we do say that around the Big Bang, space was contracted to a very small volume. So it was just a tiny little thing. And time itself, you know, the flow of time, only really started as space itself started to expand. So in a sense, the way we physicists think about time, you know, time is a measure of transformation. If stuff doesn't change, you don't really need time to explain anything, because if everything is the same, there is no transformation, there is no change, there is nothing that you have to quantify as changing. So time is a measure of transformation. And the point is that before the Big Bang, if you want to say that, there was really no time and there was really no space either. So it's very hard for us to position ourselves outside the universe and say, this is what's going on with the universe. And this is indeed, you just touched on a very central point and a very central difficulty that we have in what we call cosmology, which is the study of the universe, is how can we figure out the Big Bang, you know, the singularity, we call it, the beginning of everything. And it is indeed a very, very complicated question.
And there are people who have discussed different ideas about perhaps multiple universes out there, and they're fascinating, and there are things like string theory. What are we to do with fascinating ideas about the nature of the universe that are inherently untestable?
So again, you nailed it down. So that's the problem, untestability. So, you know, the physics code, right? I mean, the way we do things is by saying, look, I want to understand the world the best way I can. And in order to do that, I have two fundamental tools. I have my instruments, the stuff I can measure stuff with, and I have my intuition, my ideas. And I have to use them both together in order to make sense of such complicated things. Now, the point, though, is that you can use your intuition, your ideas, to create a hypothesis about this or that, like the beginning of the universe, or what is the nature of light. But the point is that you're only doing science if your hypothesis can be tested by experiments or by observations, right? So that's sort of like the fundamental core of scientific theories. If you cannot test your idea, if you cannot even contemplate a test of your idea, then you're not really doing physics, you're doing perhaps metaphysics. So traditionally, science has always had ideas that were kind of untestable, and then most of them became testable. For example, the atom, the idea that matter is made of tiny little bits, is a very, very old idea. You know, it's been around since the ancient Greeks, like 600 BCE, so about 2,600 years ago. However, it only became testable early in the 20th century, right? But it became testable. We could now do things. We can measure things directly that tell us that we do have, that matter is indeed made of atoms. So the problem with ideas such as, so the multiverse is a little separate from string theory. You know, you could have a multiverse coming from string theory, but you don't need string theory to have a multiverse. So let's unpack your stuff a little bit. So what is a multiverse, first of all? Well, the idea, at least in words, is very simple, is that our universe, that is the stuff that I mentioned that is within our cosmic information bubble, is not the only universe that exists. There may be other universes out there, and in principle, these other universes may have matter and energy and other things with properties somewhat different from the ones in our universe. So you could imagine that you have a collection of different universes, just like when you go to a soccer game and you see different people, you have different universes with different properties, you know, like people have different heights and eye color, etc. You have universe with different properties, right? So ours would not be so special anymore. It would be just one of many. The problem with that, and that's a very nice and beautiful idea, the problem is, can we make it scientific? That is, can we prove that the multiverse exists? And that's where things become a little more complicated, because by definition, those other universes are outside our universe. They are outside our information bubble. So we could never see directly a multiverse. So you could perhaps have some sort of signature from an indirect way. And people have thought about that. Very creative friends of mine have thought about a way in which, hey, perhaps if there was a universe that in the past collided with our universe, like two soap bubbles that collide with one another, when two soap bubbles collide, they sort of shake a bit so that the matter, the walls of the bubble, they kind of undulate. And so those disturbances in the distribution of matter in the bubble would be somewhat similar to what would happen to the distribution of matter in our universe. So we would see some sort of wavy patterns in the matter and radiation, in principle, especially radiation in the sky. So are there rings like that in the sky? Well, so far, no one has seen one, and we don't know if they exist.
My guest is Marcelo Gleiser, professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. We have lines open now if you've got a question. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Marcelo Gleiser, professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College and author of the new book, The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Marcelo, explain what the uncertainty principle is in quantum mechanics and how that plays into what we can know.
So the uncertainty principle is one of these annoying certainties that we have in nature, which is the following, is that we can never tell with 100% accuracy where a little bit of matter is and what is its speed. So it sounds very abstract, but the idea is I think your older listeners would know or have played with mercury when, you know, quicksilver when they were little kids. I did because my father was a dentist. And the idea is that the more you try to squeeze that little thing, right, the more it escapes you. Hmm. And essentially, if you now transport that analogy to electrons and the things that make up atoms, what you see is that the more you want to pinpoint where an electron is, the less able you are to do that, because it turns out that the way you see an electron is by shooting light at it. And light, believe it or not, being a wave, can push things around. So the more you want to localize an electron, the more you want to shoot light at higher energy at that electron, and you end up shooting yourself on the foot, because as the light hits the electron, it pushes it away. So you can never be completely sure exactly where a fundamental particle is, and that's the uncertainty principle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Carrie in Arlington. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there. I have a question regarding the speed of light. We know, or think we know roughly, you know, what the speed of light is, but do we know why that is the speed of light? What limits it to that? Is it gravity, or is that something that's just unknowable? And I will hang up and turn my radio off and listen to the answer. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, Carrie. And it turns out that we have no idea why the speed of light is the number that we measure. It is the 186,000 miles per second. It's what we call a fundamental constant of nature, which basically means is stuff that we measure, like this, the strength of gravity and the quantum mechanical, little quantum mechanical uncertainty also is related to a fundamental constant called Planck's constant. And we do not know the reasons for those values. Okay, they are things that we just accept as they are. However, since you asked, there are ways in which we can try to figure these things out. And these are the so-called string theories, or more generally, unified theories of nature, where we try to come up with very abstract mathematical constructs where the values of those constants would be predictable from a single fundamental constant. Unfortunately, those constructions, you know, those mathematical constructions called string theory, they also have no empirical validation. That is, we haven't really tested them in any way, and it does not look promising for them right now. So as it is right now, we have to accept the speed of light and the strength of gravity and the mass of the electron. There are quite a list, like about 20 or so or more, actually, fundamental constants that we just have to take their values as they are.
How did we get to the point that we began to look to mathematics as a way to describe the universe?
Well, that's a question about the history of science. And in a sense, my book traces the whole arc of how our knowledge of nature evolved in time, starting with the pre-Socratic Greeks. And I think you have to really go back there in order to understand where mathematics comes in. I mean, it's clear that, you know, cavemen, they were counting and they were making pictures, they were estimating distances. And so, you know, the rudiments of mathematics come from counting and from trying to figure out the shapes of things, you know, so numbers and geometry, right? And what happened, though, is that when you go to ancient Greece, so around 600 or so BCE, right, before the Common Era, a group of people started to think about nature in a different way. Instead of associating natural phenomena to the will of different kinds of gods, they said, can we try to understand nature using reason? And once you make that leap, you want to use reason, mathematics comes in as your best tool, because with mathematics, you can actually think about what's going on, and you can quantitatively measure things and group things. And that's where this origin of mathematics and this link between mathematics as a language of nature originated. So famously, a fellow called Pythagoras that everybody remembers, I hope, from the theorem, the Pythagorean theorem of triangles from high school algebra and geometry. Well, that Pythagoras was one that associated directly numbers as the language of nature. So I think it's there that you can trace the roots of this relationship, very deep relationship between the way nature operates and the way mathematics is used to describe nature. And you can see that because nature is very kind to us in many ways and sometimes not so kind. But in the ways that it is kind is when it displays all the regular cycles. So you see phases of the moon, you see tides, you see the seasons. So there is some sort of regular pattern or patterns that are repeated very regularly. And those regular patterns are very easily described by mathematical rules. And so comes this idea that perhaps there are laws of nature which are described through mathematics that can describe also not just the way nature operates, but the very essence of reality, that the whole of reality is just a big mathematical game, just like a fellow like Plato, for example, believed. You know, so Plato took Pythagoras to heart and said, if you really want to understand the essence of reality, the truth about everything, don't be fooled by our senses. Use instead mathematics, because mathematics is the real truth, and mathematics is beautiful. And hence, if God is a designer of the universe, then we have to understand mathematics in order to understand God's mind.
So is mathematics something that we have discovered or something that we have invented? And why does it matter, the distinction between those two?
Well, you know, this is a very old debate as well. You know, are these mathematical truths like 2 plus 2 equals 4, you know, something that is a universal truth that if you have aliens in a different planet, they can think, are they also going to come up with 2 plus 2 equals 4? Are they going to come up with prime numbers, the square root of 2 and stuff like that? Or are they going to develop a completely different language? And you have two schools of thoughts here, okay? So one school of thought is what people loosely call the Platonic school, which is that, yes, mathematics exists in some sort of abstract realm of truth. Nobody knows where that place is, but the idea is that it lives in the mind. And the mind here is either the mind of God, and we can approach that mind through our reason. And what we are doing is plucking those truths from this realm of beauty and mathematical purity and translating it into human language, so to speak. So that's the Platonist, which is a very, very religious way of thinking about mathematics. Then you have the other school, which is a much more pragmatic school, saying this is all nonsense. Mathematics is the product of our brains. We invent the whole thing in order to order and make sense of the world around us. And we are creatures, we humans are creatures that are very much part of the world as we evolved within it. That is, we are sons and daughters of the earth. We evolved through the history of the earth, and our brains evolved in order to be very well adapted to this reality. And hence, our mathematics really is an expression of our evolution of who we are as human creatures. Meaning, if you have other aliens out there, they're going to have a completely different way of relating to reality, relating to nature.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ken on the line from Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm curious to know what you think about this. This sort of a false equivalency has developed on the religious right, and it has to do with the fact that because science, and this is the beautiful thing about it, is so malleable, it changes over time. Because it's so malleable that there's no difference between, quote, believing in a particular theory or disbelieving a particular theory versus believing in a particular deity or believing in a particular religious faith. What is scientific knowledge? How itself, if it is, how is it different than believing in anything? If it's going to be so malleable, if it's going to be so changeable, just talk a little bit about the difference between scientific knowledge, believing in it, and believing in anything.
Great. That's a great question. Thank you. And tongue-in-cheek, you know, my quick answer to that is, look, if you thought science was based on belief, you wouldn't go into an airplane and fly, right? Because and that's the whole point. I mean, there is a huge amount of science that goes into building an airplane, and you know that the belief that we talk about in science is very, very different in nature from the belief that we talk about in religion. So essentially, the idea is that the belief in science is based on our perspective, in a sense. We think that we can create theories about nature that can be validated through experiments. And based on these results, we can build machines, we can do all sorts of wonderful things, like fly a rocket to the moon or build an iPhone, etc. So when people say scientists also have belief in their description of the world, that is true. And sometimes we do extrapolate our belief. So, for example, when Newton developed his theory of gravity, he only tested it within the solar system, meaning, you know, around the sun and the planets and comets and stuff. But he very quickly called it the system of the world. And what he meant by the world was the universe as a whole, meaning the whole universe operated according to the same rule of gravity as it does around our solar system. So that's a leap of faith, so to speak, right? Because you don't really have any true verification that gravity is the same across the universe, or didn't in the time of Newton, but he went ahead and did it. Now, what happens then is that we use this extrapolation to go out and test our theories, and either it's going to hold or it's not. And that's the difference, fundamental difference between belief in science and belief in religion, because belief in science is always being questioned by experimental evidence, and belief in religion is a matter of faith and is not being questioned by experimental evidence.
What does it take for scientists to remain open to the possibility that what appear to be well-established truths might at any moment be revealed to be incorrect?
You know, that's the very core of science, is to be open to precisely this, right? I mean, there shouldn't be anything that is final in science. The more we learn about the world, the more we understand that our vision of reality is always changing. Let me give you an example which is very concrete. So let's go back to Columbus, right? So Columbus came here, or around here anyways, in 1492. What kind of universe did Columbus live in? Well, completely different from the universe that, say, Newton, just about 150 years lived afterwards. So, for example, for Columbus, you had the Earth was fixed at the center of everything. It didn't move anywhere, right? And the stars and the planets and the moon moved around the Earth. And then you had, like, it was sort of like an onion-shaped cosmos, right? One thing inside another, inside another, inside another. And at the very end, at the very circumference of the universe, you had what they called the sphere of the fixed stars. And beyond that, you had the divine sphere, the Imperium Primum Mobile, it was called. So it was a universe that Newton then said, hey, this is not right. Our universe is not finite. The universe is infinite. Things are moving around. The Earth moves around itself, like Copernicus had said before him. And the Earth is also moving as a planet around the sun. So he had a completely different universe than Columbus has. And then we go to the 20th and 21st century, and our universe, again, is completely different from Newton's universe. His law of gravity is an approximation to what we call now our law of gravity, which is Einstein's theory of general relativity, which generalizes Newton's theory of gravity by extending it to realms where Newton's theory would fail. And that's very much like what science does. You know, it doesn't necessarily throw out old ideas, but extends it to more and more novel realms. And so it's not like Newton is wrong about the way he does gravity, but if you apply Newton's theory of gravity to study a black hole or the Big Bang, you're going to get the wrong results. So in a sense, science is always kind of expanding itself. It's a self-correcting enterprise based on the accumulation of data. And we have to be, as scientists, we always have to have a very open mind about what could be happening out there, simply because nature is much smarter than we are. It's very creative, and we are essentially always playing a catch-up game.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just had a quick question about that mystical threshold between the quantum world and the one that we observe. And can your guest give us an idea of sort of where is the theoretical boundary between the quantum world and when it basically takes the properties on that we relate to? And I'll listen off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
That's a very, very good question as well. So you're asking what's the boundary between what we call the quantum and the classical world. So the classical world, and I spent quite a long time in the book talking precisely about this issue. So the classical world, as you said, is the world that we see, right? The world we perceive with our senses, where everything is standing still. You don't see stuff jiggling around, right? And I just mentioned before that in the quantum world, things are completely different, right? You have electrons, they're always jiggling around. They're never standing still. So where is the boundary? I mean, where does this quantum description become the classical description, that is the stuff that we see? And it turns out that that boundary is not well defined. And the way to think about that is you have to specify what kind of system you're dealing with and then try to explain that. But roughly, when you have things at the cellular level, like many, many molecules, big molecules, you start looking into the classical world.
My guest is Marcelo Gleiser, professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. We'll take more of your questions after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marcelo Gleiser, professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy at Dartmouth and author of The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Marcelo, before we get back to the physical properties of the universe, we should talk about the limitations of the human brain and the extent to which our cognitive abilities are part of what keeps us from being able to know everything there is to know.
So that's like perhaps the greatest mystery of them all, right? Because in a sense, everything that we know about the world and about ourselves fits inside our heads. And that's where the mystery really begins, right? What is the brain, and how come the brain, through neurons and its connections called synapses, can engender us with a sense of self? How do you know that you are you, and how come you're going to be you tomorrow when you wake up and you have this continuity, you know, you have your personality, so to speak? And we obviously have no clue about that, right? So cognitive neuroscientists are definitely making enormous progress understanding several aspects of how the brain works, but it is really difficult because, again, somewhat like the universe, you cannot step outside our heads in order to understand what's going on. We're kind of stuck inside. And it's, from an insider's perspective, it's much harder to kind of understand things. So can the brain figure out how it works? That's the real question. Now, people imagine. And again, here you have two different camps, perhaps even more than two. Actually, you do have more than two. There are three, essentially. One of them is that, you know, all you have to do is gather the information about the brain. The brain is a finite system. It has about 85 billion neurons and a trillion synapses or so, and you can put that in a computer, model this whole stuff up and how the neurotransmitters move from one synapse to another, and you can create a giant computer simulation, and if you do this right, that simulation is going to be just like a brain. So that's sort of the reductionist approach, right, that you can actually do construct a brain bottom up. Then you have people to say that you can't do that because there is also the soul, you know, and the soul is not material. And so even if you model the matter of the brain, you could never understand the essence of consciousness because there is this thing which is the immaterial soul. Now, let me say that the vast majority of scientists and philosophers thinking about this issue do not believe in the soul in any sense whatsoever, you know. So, and one of the basic reasons for that is what people call the binding problem. The binding problem is the following: like, if there is something like a soul, how does it, being immaterial, connect with the rest of the brain, which is material? So if there is a relationship between the soul and the rest of the brain, then the soul becomes material, and if it's material, you should see it, but we don't, hence the soul doesn't exist. So the binding problem, and there are other reasons as well, kind of convince us, most of us anyways, that there is no soul. But then you have the third group that says that even if there is no soul, so even if the brain is just pure matter, that is, neurons and synapses connecting to each other, we still cannot figure out how we think. We cannot figure out our consciousness. And this is called by philosopher David Chalmers, it's called the hard problem of consciousness. And the hard problem of consciousness is to understand the essence of our subjective experience. So when I see the color red, and when you, Chris, see the color red, we may think we are seeing the same thing, but we are experiencing it differently. And the point is that I cannot see the color red as you can, and you cannot see the color red as I can. And there is something profoundly mysterious about this sense of subjective understanding. And in fact, the scientists and philosophers that believe that we are unable, cognitively unable to understand the brain, have this awesome name. They're called the New Mysterians. You know, and one of them is Colin McGinn, a philosopher who's a kind of controversial guy, but they're also like Steve Pinker and a bunch of other people. So the New Mysterians say that we humans are unable to understand what consciousness really means. And that doesn't mean that it's impossible to understand. Perhaps a future intelligence or some alien has figured it out, but we cannot do it. The same way that we cannot teach a mouse to recite poetry because it's cognitively impossible for the mouse to recite poetry. We are cognitively impaired when it comes to understanding consciousness, which basically is deeply related to understanding the essence of reality and the possibility of building machines that can actually think and also become human-like.
And even if we were to create some artificial intelligence that had vastly greater capabilities than we do, it wouldn't do us any good, right? Because those artificial intelligence entities would understand something, and we would still not be in a position to understand what they had discovered.
Right. I mean, it's going to be very hard for you to read Edgar Allan Poe to your dog and have the dog appreciate it for what it is. It may hear the sounds and stuff, but it won't know, you know, what Edgar Allan Poe is talking about. And we don't spend much time talking to ants either. So who knows? You know, maybe it's true. Maybe it's true that there are ways in which we can understand consciousness. But I'm very sympathetic to this notion of the New Mysterians. I think that in some ways, in somewhat analogous ways, the same problems that we face when we try to understand the universe as a whole, it's what Aristotle called the first cause. How do we understand the cause that has been uncaused, so to speak? And this is the problem that has been propagated through the history of knowledge, and I explored this a lot in the book. And modern cosmology is trying to figure the same thing with the Big Bang. You know, what make the bang bang, so to speak. You know, what was it? You know, what can make the bang bang? And in a similar sense, the difficulty we have there is we can't go outside our universe to figure it out. We can't go outside our brain to figure it out. And so in a very deep way, the brain, the nature of consciousness, becomes another one of those unknowables that exists in this ocean of the unknown, things that we may be very hard, if not impossible, for us humans to figure out.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Michael on the line in Frisco. Hello, Michael.
Hey, hello. How are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I find this to be an absolutely incredible topic, one of my two favorites, the other being religion, because each topic, I think, requires a certain amount of faith. That being said, I've noticed that in most of the theories to explain the existence of the universe, all infer a beginning, a middle, and an end, whether it be the multiverse, string theory, brain theory, or the Big Bang itself. Again, a beginning, a middle, and an end. So my question is, do cosmologists and theoretical physicists have an aversion to the concept of infinity?
Were you able to hear that, Marcelo?
I think so, yeah. So if cosmologists have an aversion to the concept of infinity, actually, no, we don't. But let me say something about infinity, because that's a very good question. So what is infinity, right? Infinity is one of these things that is an idea, right? It's not something, it's something you can hold in your head, but you cannot measure, right? So we could never find out if the universe is infinite or not. Remember when I mentioned that the universe, that what we can see of the universe is this cosmic bubble of information because of the speed of light, is what we call the cosmic horizon. But just like the horizon we see from the beach, you know that the ocean continues beyond the horizon. So we know the universe continues beyond what we can see. What we can't know is if the universe continues forever, meaning is it spatially infinite or not, right? But the multiverse, you mentioned the multiverse is an attempt to create infinities, you know. So the multiverse, in principle, if it existed, it would be infinite in time, meaning it would have no beginning or end, and each universe would be an event. You know, the Big Bang would be an event that happened within this multiverse, like a bubble popping up in a soup, so to speak. So the universe itself would have time, it would have space, but a finite time and a finite space, but the multiverse itself could be infinite in space and infinite in time. So it's not that we have an aversion. I would say that the problem with the infinite is that we cannot ever be sure that it exists either in space or in time. So it becomes, again, an unknowable.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Chris on the line in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Again, a great topic. And I had a couple of examples I hope the guests will comment on with regard to kind of the boundaries of what we're dealing with between classical and Einstein. And the one boundary I would posit is this Cassini spacecraft that we have orbiting Saturn, and it was slingshotted, and those orbits are all calculated, and there's a lot of them. Just using the Newtonian, you know, they don't have to think in terms of relativity. And the other example would be when Einstein, early in his career, had his theory of relativity. People didn't understand it, didn't believe it. And he said, well, you know, if there's going to be an eclipse, and if you look at this certain star, it will be right next to the sun, and a shifted position. And lo and behold, it was. And so, and that one's obviously harder for people like me to understand. So I hope the guests can comment on how good examples those might be.
Okay. So the Cassini spacecraft, absolutely. When you shoot a rocket into the solar system and you compute the orbits and where it's going to go and use gravity-assisted slingshot, as you mentioned, to propel it somewhere else, you're only using Newtonian physics. And and it works perfectly fine. And the reason for that is that the corrections that come from Einstein's theory of gravity only are important when you have very strong gravitational fields. So when you're talking about planetary physics, it really doesn't matter. But just to give you an example, it matters a tiny little bit because our GPS is corrected by relativistic effects. So to be really precise, a GPS needs to use the theory of relativity. Now, when it comes to, but not for shooting a rocket ship, because you don't need that kind of accuracy in that case. Now, when it came to Einstein, you're absolutely right. In 1915, when he came up with the theory of relativity, general relativity, his theory of gravity, he said, you know, gravity could be understood as the bending of space around a piece of matter, just like when you sit on your couch or on your mattress, you see it's deformed around your body. So the bigger the mass of the body, the bigger the deformation. And so that means that when you're looking at a star that has light coming by the sun, you could probably see a deviation just because space around the sun will be distorted by the mass of the sun. But, of course, you can't look at a star in the same line of the sun because you get blind. So you have to wait for an eclipse. So when the sun is covered, you can see the light of the star from far away, and you will see that when the sun is between the star and our eyes, it does have a deflected path. And Einstein calculated the amount of that deflection, and in 1919, two expeditions were sent to Africa and Brazil, and they detected precisely the angle that Einstein had predicted, and he became overnight a superstar.
Has the hunt for a theory of everything gone away?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it has gone away, but it's living dangerously right now. You know, because the core of this theory of everything is an idea called supersymmetry, which I don't think we have time to go into, but it would be something that if it exists, we should be seeing it right now. We should be seeing it in the same machine that found the Higgs, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, and we have not found it. So the diehards are saying, but that's okay, let's wait a little longer because next year that machine is going to have double its energy and then supersymmetry will appear. But most people are beginning to doubt that supersymmetry is the right idea to describe the properties of matter. And if it isn't, the theory of everything is going to have a lot of trouble, which is something that I have to say I predicted some time ago. I do not think a theory of everything is a good idea in physics.
But it doesn't bother you that we'll never achieve that?
No, not at all. You see, so people, when I talk about the limits of knowledge, you know, people say, well, that's such a downer. You know, are you basically saying that we can't understand everything? I said, precisely, we don't have to carry the burden of final truth. Science is made step by step. You know, there are all sorts of mysteries and discoveries that we can do without having to create a science that is like godlike, you know, that can explain everything. The whole notion that we can even understand everything doesn't make any sense whatsoever, simply because we don't even know all the questions. And if we don't know all the questions, how can we possibly answer all of them?
Marcelo Gleiser is author of the new book, The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. He joined us today from the studios at Dartmouth College, where he's professor of natural philosophy, physics, and astronomy. Marcelo, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. I had a great time as well. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.